Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Those purchasing health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, could pay an average of 4.9% more in 2019. Even though it's an increase over this year, the rate hike is seen as good news, considering rates have gone up by a whole lot more in previous years, and the states surrounding Pennsylvania will have much higher rates. So what's behind these rates? To explain, with us today is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner, Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So right off the bat, I want to clarify that we are early in the process, that these are the proposed rate increases that have been submitted by the insurance companies here in Pennsylvania. It will be later in the year when final decisions are made. So 4.9%, it's still an increase, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but much less than it's been in previous years. Why do you think that happened?
Yeah, so there are a lot of things happening in our market, and obviously there's been a lot happening and a lot of questions at the federal level as well. I think the good thing about our market is that it is competitive. We have had a number of insurers remaining committed to the market, and this year, while we are seeing relatively low increase requests, and of course, as we'll talk about, my department does review those requests and gets to say yes or no at the end of the year, we're also seeing a really significant increase in the options that consumers are going to see. So 31 of Pennsylvania's 67 counties will have more insurance companies offering coverage on the health insurance exchange compared to this year. And of the 20 counties that currently only have one insurer, only eight will be that way next year. And so that competitive market, competition works for consumers, and I think that's contributing to the price increases. At the same time, Governor Wolf and I are really committed to doing everything that we can at the state level to maintain access, to work towards affordability, and to make sure that consumers can get the care that they need. And we've really done all of the things that we can do and all of the right things at the state level to keep people in the market, to keep insurers in the market, and have that stable risk pool that's also keeping prices moderate.
Like what? What's the state done?
Sure. So last year, coming into open enrollment, we were facing a situation where the federal government had cut the open enrollment period in half. They had cut their marketing and outreach budget, and we had previously relied on the federal government to do that by 90%. And they had also cut funding for navigators who work in our communities every year by 50%. So we were really concerned that people wouldn't have access to the timely and accurate information they needed about basic things like, when do I have to enroll in coverage? So we pulled together a really great group of stakeholders across the state, including the insurers, consumer advocacy organizations, legislators, provider organizations, and we put together our own outreach and media campaign trying to reach people. And I give that great credit because at the end of the day, a lot of people thought we were going to lose a significant percent of the people from that market. And while we did lose a small number, 400,000 people still enrolled in the exchange. And that was really good news and one of the reasons why our market is still stable, because we have a stable group of people in it.
Mm-hmm. So we did lose some people.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any figures in mind of what we would lose, what you thought we would lose, and what we actually did?
Yeah, I never put a number to it, but there were estimates out there in the 10 to 20%, and we lost well under 10% of the market.
And right now, according to the news release that we got this week, that there are a record number of people here in Pennsylvania that are insured, correct?
Yeah, according to the most recent census data, only 5.6% of Pennsylvania residents are uninsured, which is by far the lowest it has ever been. And it was in the double digits before the Affordable Care Act came into place. And that's because of this individual market, and also largely because of the really critical decision that Governor Wolf made to expand the Medicaid program here in Pennsylvania, which covers well over 700,000 people.
A lot of these things have happened in other states. Medicaid being expanded. I don't know how aggressive other states have been with outreach and trying to get their residents to keep them involved. But why has it worked better here in Pennsylvania than in some other states?
Yeah, you know, I don't have the benefit of knowing other states as well as I know Pennsylvania. What I can say here is I think it's been a combination of factors that are working well together. Factors about our market, such as particularly its competitiveness, and what we've seen is a stability of the risk pool, meaning the people that are staying in the market, and what we have done as a state to keep insurers in the market and to react to what's happening at the federal level as best we can.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, even though you say you're not familiar with what other states are doing, you have pointed out that states surrounding Pennsylvania have an increase averaging over 20%.
Right. What I don't know very well is the demographics of their market, of their population, of their insurers. So no question, while only a handful of states have released what their rate increase requests are, and of course, theirs are requests as well, so we have to keep that in mind, Pennsylvania is the lowest so far.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you think the competition is a real reason in some of the efforts that your department and the Wolf administration has made. But At the same time, there are a lot of other things going on. You mentioned the federal government. One thing in particular, and I want to find out if it's too soon to tell, the individual mandate. Congress rolled back the individual mandate that required people to purchase insurance or have to be insurance or to have insurance, I should say, or they would pay a penalty come tax time. There were a lot of predictions that meant that there would be more uninsured people and that rates would go up if there were more uninsured people. Is it too soon to tell, or hasn't that happened here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so I think the fear with the individual mandate is that what the result will be is healthier individuals who see less value in purchasing health insurance will choose to forego health insurance or choose an alternative type of insurance plan that covers a whole lot less and doesn't really have the comprehensive benefits and consumer protections of the ACA. They'll leave the market, and those that need that comprehensive coverage the most, those who have medical conditions that they know they'll need, will stay in. And that will result in prices going up even more. So that's the concern. I think it is a little bit early to see what the full impact of that will be, but certainly keeping our market stable and affordable, I hope will help people stay in. What I'll say on the positive end of that question is last year with that open enrollment, with everything I talked about before being changed, but also the Trump administration's decision to stop making payments for the cost-sharing reduction program that helps low-income individuals and families pay for their out-of-pocket costs like copays and deductibles. And all of the headlines and all of the uncertainty about repeal and replacement and was the individual mandate going to be removed or not enforced, people really thought that we would see a large exodus out of the market, either because people already thought that it was gone or didn't know whether it was or didn't think it was worth their while because it was so uncertain or didn't want to risk it. And when we didn't see that, you know, I think that one of the outcomes of that debate is people are really understanding the value of coverage and the value of knowing that they have coverage guaranteed to them, and that's keeping them in the market.
Mm-hmm. Would you go as far as saying Pennsylvania's marketplace has stabilized?
You know, I never like to go that far because there is much at risk in the future. And in particular, in addition to the individual mandate, the Trump administration is looking at some proposed rules that would make more available types of coverage that don't have to comply with many of the things that we're talking about. So they may be able to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions. They may exclude critical benefits like pharmaceutical drugs, mental health and substance use disorder coverage, maternity coverage. And once again, the fear there is that those plans will draw those healthier people out of the market. Now, other states have already seen, and these are, to use the term, short-term limited duration plans and association health plans are two of the things in discussion. Now, Pennsylvania, historically, some states have already seen a somewhat significant take-up of those types of plans, and that's contributing to the instability of their market. We haven't seen that here yet in Pennsylvania, and that's one of the reasons why we are in such a good place. But that doesn't mean that that's not at risk for the future if we begin to see that going forward.
Just this morning, there was a story that crossed the wire about the Department of Justice siding with 20 states that have gone to court to basically saying that pre-existing condition part of the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. It's unusual that the Department of Justice has done that, because usually the Department of Justice is siding with the law that is in place. So it is unusual that that's happening. If that were to occur, what happens?
Well, first of all, let me say, as a public official privileged to serve for Governor Wolf, who's so committed to access, I cannot fathom why a state would fight to have their residents with pre-existing conditions denied access to health insurance. So this lawsuit sort of befuddles me overall. I will also say that this will be the fourth significant legal challenge that the Affordable Care Act has faced since its time. And we're still here today with the Affordable Care Act in place. And so for that, I am hopeful that we will continue to see the courts uphold what truly is the law of the land. That being said, if that lawsuit were successful, and we're a long way from knowing what will happen with that lawsuit, probably years, that could be devastating. And it would certainly be devastating for the hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians who have what would be considered a pre-existing condition, who could then be either denied coverage altogether or denied coverage for anything related to that pre-existing condition, or simply charged a whole lot more than everybody else.
The two most popular parts of the Affordable Care Act that people from both sides of the aisle politically agreed on was coverage for pre-existing conditions, and the other was for children up to the age of 26 that could be covered. Haven't heard anything about that.
No one's talking about that.
That seems to be still pretty popular out there. But this was one of the most popular parts of it, because up until the Affordable Care Act came along, people with pre-existing conditions, many of them could not get insurance, or if they did, they paid through the roof.
That's right. And I always like to remember, we like to think of pre-existing conditions as this aberration, this thing that is so unique. But the truth of the matter is, if you look at the average American family, maybe the child has asthma. Maybe the father has high blood pressure. Maybe the mother had breast cancer previously but hasn't had a symptom in over a decade. All of those things are considered pre-existing conditions. And so it could really impact a huge number of people. And that is not a world that I want to go back to. And we're going to do everything we can here to make sure it doesn't happen in Pennsylvania.
On the other hand, there are people who probably out there, and you know, haven't heard much of them because it has been popular, the pre-existing conditions. Healthy people say, well, why should I pay more, because there are people that we know that are going to be using more health care?
Yeah, you know, I think it gets back to the principles of how we provide care for our communities, for our neighbors, for our families. And you may be healthy now, but you don't know what's going to happen to you in the future. And it's a part of making sure that everybody has access to care.
I want to talk more about the race in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. We're talking about proposals as far as rate increases, rates for Affordable Care Act or Obamacare next year, that right now from the insurance companies are 4.9%. That's the average, an average increase much smaller than in years past. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You can go to WITS Facebook page and leave a question or comment. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. If you would, walk me through the process of how the final rates are determined. So you said, you know, the insurance companies, this is the proposal. These are the rates that they're asking for, but it will be October before the final rates are determined. They may not be 4.9% increases average. What's the process?
Yeah, so all that's really happened so far is that insurers have submitted to my department what they propose to charge consumers for the 2019 plan year, so beginning January 1st, 2019. We will now spend the summer delving into those filings in great, great detail. And they do eventually become public. So if you're ever interested in really boring yourself, I recommend looking through a rate filing and seeing all the grand details in there. So I have a bunch of incredibly talented and smart what are called actuaries who work for me in the department, and they will review all of the math that goes into the rate. So what are the assumptions about how many people you're going to enroll, about how healthy or unhealthy that population will be, and how much unhealthier or healthier they will be compared to the previous year. They will look at questions like, how much do you think costs will go up for the underlying costs of care compared to last year? Do you think people are going to use more pharmaceutical drugs or less? And so we look at all of those questions and we compare the assumptions across the different insurance companies. We look closely at what the offerings are at a county basis so that we understand access, not just globally, but for consumers in every corner of the Commonwealth. And we do often push back on some of the assumptions that are being made. We do also sometimes catch mistakes that result in small changes to the rates as well. So after that process, we will tell the insurance companies what we are prepared to approve. It is often lower than what was originally proposed. So we don't know that the 4.9% will be the 4.9%. And then we finalize those rates in October.
Are the rates ever higher than proposed?
We saw that last year, and I'll explain why. Because last year, when we came into the rate filing period, insurers filed an average of 8.8%. And actually, had things gone the way they should have gone, what we would have approved was an average of about 6.5%. So that's kind of the normal process. Unfortunately, also last year, there was a lot of uncertainty at the federal level. And in addition, throughout the summer, it became clear that President Trump was going to stop making those payments for the cost-sharing reduction program that, once again, helps low-income individuals and families pay for the out-of-pocket costs like copays and deductibles. Now, that program, interestingly, that benefit has not gone away. Those consumers still have access to those lower out-of-pocket costs. It's just that instead of the federal government paying for it, the insurers have to pay for it and build it into premiums. And so when that happened in the middle of the review period last year, we had to adjust our process and allow insurance companies to file higher rates to account for the cost of providing that benefit that they are still required by law to provide. And so last year we did approve higher rates than were originally proposed, but it was because of that factor that was really out of the state's control and out of the insurance company's control.
Now, I know actuaries and the insurance department, anything having to do with insurance, that there are a lot of assumptions, there are a lot of estimates. How do you do that? I mean, that when you were talking about trying to judge how many people will be using it, how sick they will be, what pharmaceuticals will cost, there are a lot of assumptions there.
Yeah, and every year, you know, rates are an estimation. They are a projection of what insurance companies think will happen in the coming year because they also don't know what their population's healthcare needs are going to be. They don't know whether it's going to be a particularly bad flu season or whether, you know, sometimes there are singular patients with incredibly high cost healthcare needs, cancer treatments, for example, who can actually skew the costs overall. Now, those people absolutely need the treatment, but you can't always know those things in advance. And so our job is to look and see, are the assumptions reasonable or are they unreasonable? And we do that by comparing across the companies, doing outlier analyses. We do that by looking to independent estimates, for example, of how much healthcare costs are projected to grow in a given year, some of those things, and all sorts of other things that actuaries know how to do that I simply don't because I'm not an actuary. But it's a very detailed process.
Are healthcare costs, and I'm going to ask the question about the 4.9% increase, but you're in a position to see healthcare costs. Do they continue to rise at the rates that they have in the past?
Yeah, they are a little bit lower than they have been in the past, but they do continue to go up every year. And so the sad thing is that the good news in healthcare costs is when they grow less than usual, but they still grow.
Yeah.
And we are seeing that, and that is good news. But of course, we don't want them to grow at all.
What's growing more than you expected or less than you expected?
You know, I don't get into that level of detail. I think what has been growing the most, certainly in the recent years, is the cost of pharmaceutical drugs. And, you know, pharmaceutical companies will tell you there are good reasons for that, including new and improved but more expensive specialty drugs going on the market. For example, there's been a lot of discussion about the new hepatitis C treatments that are on the market that are incredibly effective but cost $80,000 for treatment for one individual. And so there are reasons that those things happen, but those are built into those trends. I think the moderation in the growth is more of a broad-based thing, not really centered on one area of healthcare.
I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but 4.9% increase is still an increase. Mm-hmm. Even though it is much smaller than it has been in previous years, it still is an increase over mm-hmm. over other years. You know, one of the big complaints that we have heard from those who have obtained insurance through the Affordable Care Act, if they are not eligible to get some of that assistance from the federal government and, as you said now, from the insurance companies, that their rates have gone up a whole lot and they're paying a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. It's still an increase. So, I mean, do we ever see the day where it doesn't increase? 4.9% is something to be happy about compared to other years, but do we ever see a day where there are no increases?
Yeah, so the unfortunate reality is, and we were talking about healthcare cost growth, they do tend to grow on average 3 to 6% each year. And so it would be make sense that health insurance costs would therefore rise 3 to 6% per year. And that's why when we see 4.9%, that is not only good news, it's what you would expect to see if the market and the insurance costs are simply reflecting what's happening to healthcare costs.
Let's take a phone call from Phil in Camp Hill. Phil, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I understand that you're talking about 4.9% increase as being somewhat good news. Last year, Highmark announced that they had $1.1 billion in profits. That's billion with a B. And I can't understand why there should be any increase whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the other part of my concern is that my wife and I are in our early 60s. We're fortunate to be able to retire a couple of years ago. Our adjusted gross income is just slightly above the threshold that would enable us to qualify for subsidies. And our rates have gone up in the last 3 years, probably 50 to 75% total since 2015. So those are just comments that I'd like to make. I would like to ask, what can we expect from those plans that don't qualify for plans that I wouldn't qualify for, that aren't on the exchange?
Hey, Phil, can I ask Phil, before you go, yes. And if you say it's none of my business and none of our audience business, just say so, mm-hmm. but can I ask what you and your wife are paying per month?
Well, I'd rather not say.
Okay, all right, that's fine. that's fine, I understand.
It's a lot.
Okay, all right.
And, you know, we pay a lot of high premium, we have a high deductible, and our copay went up from $20 to $60 for a regular visit, from $25 to $85 for a specialist visit. I'm about 15 months away from Medicare, and I'm hoping that they don't do something to ruin Medicare by that time.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Commissioner?
Yeah, so I'll say two things. One is, just because we have relatively low increases this year absolutely does not negate the fact that the costs are already incredibly high, and we know that. I am hopeful this year that in addition to the increases that we are seeing, all of that new competition will bring new options. And we're still doing the analysis to look at a county level what's available. But if you're a new plan in an area, you're actually not even counted in that increase because there's nothing to increase off of. And so many consumers will have new options. And so if you do buy in this market, this is the year where you really are going to want to log on, look at your options, because there may actually be something more affordable available to you. The other thing that I'll say is that we are absolutely continuing to advocate for some policies that are being considered in Congress that would actually have a measurable downward effect on premiums. And Governor Wolf has been really a leader working with bipartisan governors across the country to advocate for these policies. And in particular, there's a group of policies these different versions are under consideration, but all of them would help cover the costs of really expensive claims and really individuals with really expensive healthcare needs. And then everyone else would pay an average, sort of excluding those outliers. Now, that will bring down premiums, and I am still hoping the Congress will take action to create and help fund a program like that so that we can bring down costs, particularly for the individuals like those we just heard from who aren't eligible for financial assistance.
And those are the people that have been most outspoken, I think, when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, that they're above that threshold where they can get some financial assistance. And their rates have gone up a whole lot. And, you know, and the gentleman said he didn't want to say what his rates were. But, you know, we've heard people who said that they are very, very expensive. So, you know, those are the people who feel like they need some relief.
I do want to just, you know, not to at all minimize the level of concern there, but just to make sure we understand the scope of what we're talking about. So the individual market serves people who are not eligible for a public program like Medicare or Medicaid, and also do not get coverage through their employer. And that actually only provides coverage to about 5% of people in the Commonwealth and nationally. Now, of that 5%, 80% are eligible for financial assistance. So this population who is not absolutely not being well served by the market is about 1-2% of people overall. And that's why when we are looking to Congress and the discussions that are happening, I say, why move backwards for the 99% who are doing pretty well? And there are still complaints in those areas, but overall doing pretty well, when instead let's focus on actually fixing the problem for that 1%.
Real quick, before we take another phone call, you mentioned more competition or more plans available in counties. Explain how that works, because there are, you know, when you're looking, an individual looks at what's available to them, may not realize that what they're seeing is not what someone else in another county can see.
So all of our insurers here in Pennsylvania, and this current year we have 5 offering coverage on the individual market, they generally have a region that they focus on. For example, we have 3 different Blue Cross Blue Shield companies here in Pennsylvania, and they each have their own region. And the other 2 plans are both affiliated with provider systems and tend to offer where they have facilities. And so as you look to other years, they can always enter counties that they are not currently offering in. Some of them have left and entered counties over time. And this year, we are seeing a lot of interest in entering more counties and in providing coverage to more people, which means that on a case-by-case basis, depending on where you live, if you're in one of those 31 counties where they're going to be more insurers, there are going to be options that you haven't seen before, or that you haven't seen in a year or two, because sometimes carriers are entering counties they previously left.
I was about to say way back when, but it was only a year or so ago, you heard about allowing insurance companies in other states to come into Pennsylvania, for example, and Pennsylvania companies going to other states, the idea behind it to create even more competition. I haven't heard a whole lot about that lately.
Yeah, we haven't either, and I'm grateful for it. Quite honestly, the idea never totally made sense to me, because really the barrier to creating new health insurance is not state lines. It's creating a network. It's creating the relationship with the providers, building the contracts with the physicians and hospitals in a region so that you can service a population in their own communities, right? If you live in Pennsylvania, it doesn't matter to you how many doctors you can access in Nebraska. So for that reason, it was always a little bit confusing what that really meant. But also, you know, my job as insurance commissioner is to oversee the Pennsylvania insurance market and protect Pennsylvania insurance consumers. I do that through the process that I license insurers here in Pennsylvania and that I approve the products and rates that are offered here in Pennsylvania. If that happens in Nebraska, and I'm not picking on Nebraska, although I am, but I know it's just an example.
She's anti-Cornhusker, folks.
Yeah, no, I'm really not. Or Alaska, or, you know, wherever. I don't have the ability to protect consumers. And if consumers here in Pennsylvania call me and they had a plan that was regulated by someone else, I wouldn't be able to help them. And I don't want to be in that world. I want to be able to protect consumers the best I can.
Let's take another phone call. Mary is in Camp Hill. Mary, you're on the air.
Yes, my husband is an ophthalmologist in the area, and throughout the day, he receives phone calls, his staff receives phone calls that their eye meds are much more expensive than they had imagined. And my husband is asking patients throughout Pennsylvania to start calling their congressman, because unless you complain to your congressman who can help pass bills to maybe calm down the prices of pharmaceuticals, nothing is going to change, and they're going to continue to increase, and patients are going to be without their meds. We pay as much as everybody else for their meds. We get no breaks. So we need to take a stand and start calling our congressmen. That would be my advice to this state.
Thank you very much for your call, and I'm not going to ask you to advocate for one way or the other, but you probably would agree that the Congress needs to, if these prices are going to get under control, that Congress has to hear about it.
Well, certainly always contacting your legislator is the best way to be a participant in our democracy and to see change happen. Pharmaceutical drugs in particular, there is no question that those costs are increasing significantly and that it's something we as a society need to take a very close look at. And in particular, as the caller referred to, many of the ways in which that can happen are at the federal level. And so if you want to see that, calling your congressman is a great thing to do. There are some things at the state level. For example, our legislature is considering a bill that would at least create transparency to help us understand the cost of drugs. So there is some things happening at the state level, or at least under consideration at the state level. So why not call your state legislators too?
Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman, thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely.
So October final rates will come down. Okay, maybe I shouldn't say the word come down. final rates will be adopted or approved. So what should people look for here?
Yeah, so first of all, while we will release the approved rates in October, in July we will release geographic and insurance company specific information. So if consumers are really concerned and really want to understand what's going to be available in their local communities next year, starting July, there will be a lot more information available at that granular level.
Does the insurance department take phone calls, take a public comment?
Absolutely. So first of all, the rate filings themselves are specifically available for public comment. There is a public comment function on our website. So if you have something to say, either overall or about a specific company or even a specific factor in a specific rate filing, if you want to get really in the weeds, come comment. But even generally speaking, you can always call our department with questions and complaints. We assist consumers every day and go to insurance companies on their behalf to help them with their issues. We help tens of thousands of consumers each year, and actually last year we achieved almost $100 million in restitution for consumers through the work that we do on their behalf.
Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman, thank you very much for being with us, Commissioner.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The next Smart Talk road trip celebrates Made in America Tour Week at the home of American icon. Join us next Wednesday, June 13th at Harley-Davidson in York. We'll discuss the role of manufacturing in Pennsylvania's economy. Plus, you can stick around after the show for a tour of the plant. RSVP today at WITF.org/events. That's next Wednesday at Harley-Davidson in York. Will Pennsylvania's congressional districts be redrawn differently in the future? Republican State Senator Scott Wagner resigns his York County seat to run for governor full-time. And Governor Tom Wolf signs an executive order that he thinks could bring women's pay more in line with that of men. All significant issues at the state capitol this week. Joining us to talk a little bit more about it and provide some insight is WITF's Capitol Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, something you'd like to weigh in on, give us a call, 1-800 at 729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can go to WYTF's Facebook page to leave a question or a comment as well. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWYTF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. A lot to talk about, Katie. Senator Mike Fulmer was on the show earlier this week talking about a redistricting plan that he supports, but it is not the only one being considered right now, is it?
Right. No, there are a couple floating around, but I will say Fulmer's one, and it's not his bill. It's Lisa Boscola's
right.
bill.
It's both Democrat and Republican.
Right. So it's a bipartisan sort of compromise effort to get this bill, and that one is the farthest along. This Senate bill has seen a couple hearings in Fulmer's committee. It's seen a lot of back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. It's also seen some controversy because, you know, in the compromise process, it's become a very different bill than it was originally. And a lot of advocacy groups, you know, fair district advocacy groups, most of them left leaning, have taken issue with it and have sort of jumped ship on supporting it. So definitely there's just like so much focus on this particular bill. But you're right. It's not the only one. We've also got a bill from Representative Dave Reed, the House Majority Leader. He put a bill into his own committee this week, and that was sort of an unusual move. Usually they go into the House State Government Committee, where they've repeatedly sort of failed under the committee chair, Daryl Metcalf. But Reed sort of requested that his bill go into his own committee. He's in leadership.
Which committee is that?
It's the Rules Committee.
Okay.
And it's a committee, too, that doesn't usually consider substantive legislation. So usually what they do is, like, whenever something comes out of a different committee, it'll go to Rules, or if it's going on concurrence from the Senate, it'll go there. But rarely does it, you know, does something happen like this where a bill is just referred there, you know, right out the gate. And I've looked. I mean, I don't think there's any rule against it necessarily, but it's just not common practice. So anyway.
Is it an effort to bypass the state government committee that Representative Metcalf has opposed redistricting proposals?
Well, and I read it as such initially. When you ask leadership, they're like, no, Reed just says, no, I wanted it in my committee because it's my bill. And, you know, that's that. And I also have heard sort of, you know, background off the record from people that, like, if the House was able to ally itself behind a bill, no matter what committee it went to, if it went to Metcalf's committee, it would get through if there was, you know, broad support, especially from leadership behind it. So, you know, Daryl Metcalf doesn't have the power really to, like, stand in the way of the will of the House, but he can stand in the way of the will of a couple Democrats, which is what he's been doing thus far. So very different situations here. So now that the House is, you know, does have this concerted effort behind this bill, they've passed, I think it was like six redistricting bills total into that committee, the Rules Committee, yesterday. And so what that tells me is they're just trying to, like, get everything in there so they have options for this discussion that they're probably going to have next week.
So what is the difference in the bills that are being considered? I mean, you don't have to get into the minutia, but what are some of the highlights?
Well, I mean, I think just to give you, like, broad strokes of the one that's in the Senate right now, because, again, that is the one that has gotten by far the most consideration. Basically, it would create a panel of redistricting commissioners. Four would be picked by Democrats in the House and Senate. Four would be picked by Republicans in both chambers. And then three would be picked by the governor, the administration. And so, I mean, right out the gate, you know, people have had issues with the legislature picking commissioners. And so that was a contentious portion of the, like, newly revised bill that had come out. There's another, you know, portion of it. The tiebreakers basically are the legislature in this case. So if the commission can't come up with a map, can't settle on an option, it goes to the legislature. Now, this bill is probably going to get amended. So any number of those things could change. Specifically, Lisa Boscola, the sponsor, said to me, you know, pretty clearly that she thinks it's going to change in that ties will no longer go to the legislature. It'll go to the Supreme Court. Now, we haven't seen the amendment. It's supposed to be a big, like, omnibus, like, sweeping amendment coming out next week. I couldn't get my hands on a draft of it because they're still working on it. So, you know, any number of things could be in there. So I don't want to talk like it, you know, I want to keep it in generalities on that bill. Likewise, I want to keep it on generalities with all the other bills because they are, you know, super subject to change. Dave Reed's bill has gotten, I think, the most attention. He wants to do something where it's sort of a random selection process for an independent commission. So it would
just kind of, like, jury duty.
It would kind of work like jury duty. Yeah. So, you know, and there's lots of people who have issues with that, namely just kind of the fundamentals of, like, people don't like being on a jury sometimes. And it's, like, not an easy thing to do to redraw a congressional map. So if you have somebody without expertise, then you might be, you know, up a creek without a paddle, so to speak. So, I mean, lots of options here. But I think we have to keep in mind when we talk about this, like, we are coming up on a really tight deadline. And it doesn't seem like it because, you know, we have to redraw the districts in 2021. Seems like there's tons of time. But we have to pass this bill. This bill would amend the Constitution. So we have to pass it in two consecutive sessions. So really, the functional deadline here is like early July.
July 6th.
July 6th is what's been pointed out. But like that's sort of a moving target. And I'll explain why. Because like, if they get the budget done by like June 30th, they're not coming back in July. They're gone. And they're not going to come back to do redistricting unless like something's like really imminently about to happen. I'm not going to say never. But and likewise, if they don't like get the budget done and they're still working on stuff into July, like they might be able to push it a little bit. Like July 7th isn't like a drop dead date, as far as I understand it. But that being said, you know, regardless of when the drop dead date is, I'm not sure, it's coming up. So they have very little time to do this. In my conversations with various representatives, they've said, you know, we're sort of still at like 40,000 feet on this. We have not zoned in on like what exactly everyone wants to do. The Senate's close, but like you got to get the House on board. And the House is very, it's hard to get the House on board for something complicated. They're a big sort of chaotic body. So, you know, that's kind of where it is.
So many questions. But
yeah,
one thing I'm thinking about is there are those who are skeptical, have been skeptical of this process in the legislature from the beginning. Because basically, you are taking some power away from legislators to redraw these boundaries. But it seems as though there is some momentum here.
Yeah.
But behind the scenes, the insight that maybe you, what you see, does that momentum exist? Is there this groundswell of support in the legislature to reform redistricting?
I wouldn't call it a groundswell. I would call it, you know, sort of a concerted group of lawmakers have been chugging away on this issue for a long time. More lawmakers have given it lip service, but like haven't really put themselves like, you know, fully invested in getting it done. You've seen, you know, again, more of a groundswell, I think, on the Senate side, more of a willingness to actually work together towards a goal. You know, House leaders, they'll say, especially Dave Reed, who's like, you know, sort of spearheading this redistricting thing. Also, he's leaving at the end of the year. Can't go without saying that. So Reed's kind of just got nothing to lose doing like whatever he wants at this point. But like Mike Terzai hasn't been seen on redistricting. I was talking to his staff yesterday.
He's Speaker of the House.
Speaker of the House. Yeah, sorry. And I was talking to some of his staff yesterday and they were saying, no, he's like sort of he's behind it. He supports it. But he's not like making a centerpiece of this issue. So I think like there are a lot of people who don't want anything to change. There are a lot of people who like think it probably should change, but also aren't going to like, you know, do anything crazy in order to get it. And then there's some people who are very invested. Who is going to win out? I don't know, but I will just like note a word of caution. The legislature tends towards like staidness, you know, like if something could change or if something could stay the same, I'd put my money on it staying
status
the same.
Quo.
Yeah, status quo. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take that for what it is.
I'm going to switch to another issue. Republican State Senator Scott Wagner resigned his seat this week to concentrate full time on running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
Made a speech on the floor that of the Senate that got a lot of attention.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of interesting. I think it was more or less what we expected from Wagner in most ways. He kind of said, you know, I've done good things when I've been here. I stuck to my guns on, you know, spending and other issues. I worked across the aisle. He was kind of touting his own, like, bipartisanship on a couple issues. So, you know, that's all kind of par for the course for somebody who's running for governor. But he also, like, he apologized to the, I guess, legislature at large for, he said he has a strong personality, which is true, and that when he came in, he may have said things that upset people. And, you know, if that's the case, he apologizes. And I thought that was sort of an interesting note to bring in on the end of his tenure, because Scott Wagner, in my experience, hasn't been a guy who feels, you know, the need to apologize for what I think is generally called like his brashness. You know, he's not afraid to say what he thinks, whatever he thinks. And so watching him like moderate himself in that way, I'm assuming because of, you know, the fact that he is running for governor, was interesting. Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Governor Mike Steck, as president of the Senate, could have set a date for a special election for Senator Wagner's seat in York County. But he decided against it because he said he thought it would create confusion.
Yeah.
There are two other candidates, at least two, running for that Senate seat in York County. And he said it would cost too much as well. I understand that, you know, Senate Republicans said, well, okay, we're not going to argue with this.
Yeah,
because
they still keep their supermajority.
They have a big majority. But one of the things I thought of, maybe I've been being naive here, is that the people in that Senate district have no representation in the Senate for the next 6 months.
I don't think that's naive. I think that's, you know, that's valid. And that's always, you know, the question of, like, is it, you know, worth it in the eyes of the government to hold this election? They are expensive. So, you know, that's always, you know, something that comes into it. But, yeah, no, I think it's a good point.
When I say naive, meaning that I know how politics works.
Right.
But you would think that you would want people to be represented, not go 6 months without representation in the state Senate.
You would think so. Well, we've also had this issue coming up in Congress where Wolf had to schedule two special elections. And he doesn't have the option for congressional elections not to schedule them. So what he did was schedule them concurrently with the general election, but they're under different maps. So it's a whole thing. But yeah, and he got some flack for that because, again, like you said, people go without representatives for a while because of that.
Mm. Scott Wagner, Philadelphia, and this is a story I know you particularly followed.
I thought it was fun, yeah.
Malcolm X Park in Philadelphia, the grass cut. Tell me about that.
Wagner was at a campaign event at Malcolm X Park in Philly, and he... I'm putting out a story on this because I thought it was just like a funny little like political microcosm. But so he was at this campaign event, noticed the grass in Malcolm X Park was overgrown and that there was some trash around, thought this was unacceptable. And so he got on Facebook Live and basically petitioned the mayor, Jim Kenney, to cut the grass and clean up the park.
A Democrat, by the way.
Kenney's a Democrat, yes. And he said, if you don't do it, I'm going to do it. And Kenney was like... okay. And so then people did, you know, go in and they did mow the park, some, you know, city staff. And, you know, the mayor's office says that this was routine. And it was expected maintenance and that the grass was long because it's rained a lot. And so anyway, so they got in there. They apparently were there 3 days in a row. And I asked why. And they said it was because like people and families were using the park, so they couldn't do the whole thing in one swoop. So anyway, they were there like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And Wagner came back Wednesday as promised with his like grounds crew. And was like, no, you've done a bad job. He says there were like clippings everywhere and they would had done. He said, and I apologize for people listening on air. He said it was a half-assed job. I feel like because I'm quoting a senator. our former senator. But anyway, so he got in there. He, I guess, told the workers, the city workers to go home and brought his staff in and did it himself. And he says it took about 7 hours. And he brought these guys in from York and then they had to go back to York. And he did another Facebook Live, was like, I fixed the park. You're welcome. And I talked to him on the phone about this yesterday and he was like, listen, I saw a problem and I fixed it. Democrats, of course, are saying this is just like a weird, cynical political move. But, you know, maybe everyone's right.
We have a listener who said that if Scott Wagner cared about his constituents, he would stay in to represent them. This is a controversial issue because the other side would say that if you're running for governor, you're not representing your constituents. You're not devoting full time to that.
Yeah. And that was his rationale behind it. I will say, just on the point of like, is this a cynical political move or not? I talked to what was his title? It's escaping me, but an official who like represents that area in ward leader in Philly. And he, you know, has the area that park is in. And I asked him, like, does it make you upset that he did this? And he's like, no, he cleaned up the park. He can clean up the park if he wants. And then, you know, so but he also said it might be like for his own purposes.
Yeah. We only have a minute or so left,
sure.
Katie. Want to switch to an issue. You kind of, you touched on it, but we are June 8th right now.
Mm.
June 30th is the end of the fiscal year.
Yes, it is.
We are in an election year. So what are the chances? What are we hearing about budget negotiations? What are the chances of a budget being done on time?
We are hearing very chipper things from leadership. You know, I mean, I think they're like, no, we'll get it done. Like, they don't want to increase spending too much. Everybody seems sort of on board with increasing education spending in some capacity. So I think, like, there's not going to be a whole lot of controversial stuff in this budget. So, like, maybe they can get it done. I've also seen them, like, screw up those promises in the past. So who knows? But, I think it being an election year, that's a strong force. Mm. Even in 2016, when, like, there were, like, bigger fiscal problems, they got it done in mid-July.
Mm. Katie Myers, WITF's Capital Bureau Chief. Katie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on Monday's program, it's one of our programs we do every year at the beginning of the summer, beach reading or summer vacation reading. We'll be looking at the books that, recommend some books, the books that are most popular, books that maybe you should look into for the summer season. That's coming up on Monday's program, so be sure to tune in and have yourself a great weekend.